This is now talk three in the series on how to identify and handle wicked people. And so, before I begin, I've had a question handed to me, which is, how can we prevent ourselves from being overly suspicious of everyone in our lives, our family, our friends, our Christian brothers and sisters? So that's a big question, and I will be dealing with that in the future. But I would just say this as a brief aside. There is an important difference between not trusting people and distrusting people. And so to not trust simply means this, that you have not yet found within a person sufficient evidence to cause you to come to a conclusion which you feel you can reliably hold, and that is that the person can be trusted. So therefore your present position with that person is that you do not yet trust them. So you're effectively parking them. You're saying, I don't know whether this person can be trusted or not, and therefore the right way to describe it is I am not yet able to trust them. And that's materially different from saying I distrust that person. You distrust a person when there is reason to think that they are not trustworthy. So it's an important further step. So they've done or said something that causes you to believe not only that you cannot have a view, but rather that you can have a view, and that view is adverse, and that they are not trustworthy. So it's a significant further step. Now, we are not to go around thinking everybody, to go around distrusting everybody, but we are to say that we don't trust people. See the difference? So distrusting is significantly more pronounced than not trusting. You're making a positive statement that they are not trustworthy, whereas prior to that you're simply saying I'm not yet able to form a view about this person. In the absence of evidence of the nature and extent and duration necessary to form such a view, I will form no view. So for most people we would say I have no view of this person. That being so, I will not trust them. Do you see the point? And we're not ever commanded to trust anybody. We're commanded to weigh and assess and find out about people, and we're only to trust those whom we should trust. And it's always a small subset, and it's a small subset even within the church. Only a minority of Christians can be trusted. If this was the year 1870, maybe I'd say different. But in this year, 2016, that is the position in the churches I've been to. Only a minority can be trusted. So, but that issue I will pick up on again in more detail, but there isn't time to go into detail about that today. Let me get back cracking then. So let's take a closer look at the possible figures for percentages or proportions of the population that is wicked. Obviously, we can't be precise about this. And I wouldn't even pretend to be capable of being precise, because we can never also know exactly what's in other people's hearts. That's why it takes the judgment seat of Christ to judge believers really and properly and thoroughly, and it takes the great white throne judgment to judge the unbelievers, because only Jesus can understand all the complexities and the hundreds of variables and multipliers and mitigating factors that have a bearing upon a person's ultimate judgment and how they're going to be judged. I'm not capable of the maths of all that. I'm just wanting to keep it at my simple level. So broadly speaking, what can we say about numbers? Because we might have begun today with the thought that, well, there's Adolf and there's Adolf and Joseph, they're wicked. Pol Pot, he's wicked. But personally, they've never caused me any trouble. And so I haven't got a problem with this. Do you see? That's where some of us may have entered into today. I think we've hopefully moved beyond that. So we know that there are many wicked people. The question is, broadly, how many? Can we try, is it possible to get a broad brush understanding of how many people are wicked? Well, why don't we do this? Let's begin in a more general sense by looking at how God described the generation that existed on the earth at the time of the flood. That was about 1700 years after the creation. And God wiped out the whole of the population of the world, except for 8 people. And it says in Genesis 6, 5 to 8, it says, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man, and so on, and on it goes. And only Noah and Noah's family found favour, basically. Now, the point is that just before the flood, God thought that the wickedness of that generation was so great and so widespread that he needed to wipe out the entire population of the world, except for 8 people. Well, I don't suppose that all of those people were equally wicked, but taking a broad brush approach, God thought that the overall classification for them was that they were the wickedness was great, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. So that's what was true of that generation. But you notice, even in that generation, notice that God uses the word continually, and he does not use the word continuously. Have you spotted that? And that's very significant, because continually is very different in meaning. So continual wickedness, continual is a line of dots. It's a sequence, an ongoing, perhaps regular, sequence of incidents. So you would say of someone, he's continually walking his dog on that park. Means he goes on that park every day with his dog. He's continually walking his dog on that park. That doesn't mean that he, every minute of every day, is on that park walking his dog. It means he's regularly, consistently, repeatedly, in a systematic and patterned way, walking his dog on that park. So someone who's continually wicked, it doesn't mean they're wicked every minute. If it had said here that it was only evil continuously, continuously means without variation or break. So a continuous line is where you can't overtake a car. It's a continuous white line. There's no break in it. So the wickedness is all the time, without break or variation or deviation or divergence. It's continuous, all the time being wicked. The generation before the flood was not accused of that. So we might leap to our own defense and say, well, I'll tell you something, we are not like them. We're far better than that. Well, they were not wicked all the time. So if your plea in mitigation was to be this, if you were to say of your client, Your Honor, I wish to say on behalf of my client, he's not wicked all the time. Well, that's not a strong precedent, because the thing is that neither was the flood generation wicked all the time, just regularly and consistently wicked. So, who is wicked all the time? Well, probably, I think it would be Satan, and the demons are wicked continuously. Everything they ever do is wicked. They're wicked all the time. They're awake day and night, and they're wicked all the time. That's true of them. But I don't think it's true of any human being wicked absolutely all the time. Not very many, anyway. Not as a solid line. As a dotted line is the way that we are wicked. So, what would we say then? How would we think of that generation in comparison with our generation? Remember, all that God promised was that he would never flood the world again. He didn't say that he would never judge the world. On the contrary, far from promising not to, he said he will do. He's going to judge the whole world. And not just with a flood of water, but he's going to judge us with fire. There's going to be a judgment of fire on the world next time. The very world itself is going to be burned up. Its surface, at least, is going to be burned. But all the people will be put into a lake of fire. So the idea cannot say, well, God's not going to judge us again like this. No, he won't judge us with water again, but he will judge us again. And that's not a basis for thinking, therefore, that we're better than them. So let's say, what if we compared our generation with the generation that died in the flood? How do our values, attitudes, and behavior compare? All right, well, if you look at our generation, the 21st century, compare us with any century you want to mention. I can't think of any century that has done the things we do. I can't think of any century that thinks the things we think, or says the things we say, or does the things we do. Until really the 20th century, the entire world always believed in creation. Even if they weren't Christians and weren't believers, they believed in the Creator. They knew there was a Creator. It's obvious. It's only in the 20th century that that ceased to be the case in the Western world. Until now, homosexuality, even in really bad places, was in pockets, it was rare, it was exceptional. And throughout all the centuries, homosexuality has been something exceptional, even in wicked places. Now, it's on a vast scale. But not only is it on a vast scale, it's being flaunted and trumpeted and exalted and praised and made something glorious, a wonderful thing. There has never been a time anywhere in history when any significant number of people didn't know what gender they were. Now, if you have to tick these boxes, I had to tick a box the other day to be an organ donor if I get run over. And it gave me a bunch of options about my gender. Male and female was just like, well, that was a couple of them. But you could be transgender, you could be no gender, you could be this or that. This is on an official form. They are sanctioning this kind of nonsense in a way that no generation has ever thought it conceivable that there could ever be a time when the world could be so utterly stupid as this. And not only that, but paedophilia, the promotion of Islam, the crusade generation, I'm not backing what they did because the crusaders went out and killed a lot of Jewish people, which obviously was very wrong of them. And the crusaders weren't Christians, they were Roman Catholics. Nevertheless, the crusaders had enough common sense to know they needed to oppose Islam. Our generation doesn't have enough common sense to cross a road without a grown-up present. And it can't look at Islam and see it for what it is. And so you're having Islam now promoted and pleas in mitigation are being given for Islam by all sorts of well-intentioned liberals. And so I don't think there's ever been a generation as wicked as we are. But the principal point is this. There has never been a generation in the history of the world that has aborted its children like we have. In the United States, 58 million children have been put to death. In the UK, 8 million. The proportions are roughly the same. And in some parts of America, more black babies are aborted than are allowed to live. That's the proportion. So the thing is, if you went back to the flood generation, they were not aborting their children. Perhaps sometimes they did. They did carry out a practice called infanticide, where they would expose children, leave them out in the cold and let them die. But that was done here and there, now and again. But what we're doing is killing children on an industrial scale. Now, if you look at what happened with the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s, some people think about the Nazis and think, how did the Germans let it happen? Only 7% of Germans were Nazis. 93% were not Nazis. But the 93% let the 7% do it and went along with it. And we would think of them, we'd think, well, that's just obviously wicked to put people in gas chambers and so forth, obvious. But our generation is doing far more than the Nazis did. Far more. Vastly more. And yet we don't look upon it as wicked. And much of the time, this is why I said at the beginning of today, we need to really examine our definitions, our thinking, change the meanings of words and get them right. So when we look at something like industrial scale abortion being carried out in our midst, you ask yourself, what is the church doing about it? The answer is virtually nothing whatsoever. The overwhelming majority of Christians have got nothing whatsoever to say about abortion. And even those who say something say it now and again. They might retweet a tweet, or they might click like on a Facebook post, and that's it. But they won't do anything apart from that. And in particular, leaders in churches are not speaking out on this. So we might look back with a superior tone at the Germans of the 1940s and say, how could they do it and not speak up? Right, well, they were facing a brutal Nazi regime and they were a speech marks only, I say speech marks only, killing about 10 million people. But we are killing tens of millions, you see, and we're not doing anything about it. So what I'm saying is, we've got to re-look at this and recalibrate. And I would strongly suggest it may well turn out in the end that our generation, God considers us worse than the flood generation. The mere fact that he's not flooding the world, that just shows that he's not choosing to use a flood as the means of dealing with us. He's going to deal with us in other means, by other ways. He's already said what he's going to do. So, but if you look, how seriously does God take the killing of children? Just that one thing. Leave aside gender confusion, homosexuality, Islam, political correctness, and all of that. Witchcraft. It says here in Deuteronomy 12, 30 and 31, speaking about these people. It says, they even burn their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. Talking about the Canaanites. Now the Canaanites were a generation considered so wicked that they needed to be wiped out so that the Hebrews could take their land. And they were so wicked that their very racial line had to be just exterminated because they were so wicked. All right, well, what was so wicked about them? One of the things was that they burned their own sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Well, that's why I'm saying recalibrate. Look at what our generation is doing. Are we better or worse than the Canaanites? Better or worse than the flood generation? What about Sodom and Gomorrah? Did they have, we know that they had homosexuality. How much homosexuality? I don't know. But did they have fraud, witchcraft, pornography, drugs, adultery, fornication? Did they have people denying their own gender? Did they have industrial scale abortion? There's no reason to think they did. And yet we look upon Sodom as being almost the epitome of evil and wickedness. But in many ways, Sodom was a better managed and better conducted town than the towns we live in. If you open your eyes to see it. But look at what God said about Sodom and Gomorrah. He said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great and their sin is very grave. That's what he said about them. So I think it's right and proper that we should compare ourselves and not leap to our own defence, but compare ourselves honestly. And if you do so, I think you'll find that if we are not as wicked as Sodom, we are so rapidly going downhill. We're on a skateboard on a sort of very steep hill going down very fast. Well, I'm not that ancient, but I grew up really in the 1970s. And the 1970s is unrecognizable from today. But some people grew up in the 1950s and 60s and 40s even. Those decades are unrecognizable from today. Totally unrecognizable. And if you add to all those things I've spoken of, if you were to add to that the just wholesale abandonment of Christianity in the Western world, since the 1960s, really, it's gathered pace. And add to that a vast embracing of witchcraft and the occult. It's on a vast scale. The Harry Potter books not only brought about, but also responded to the interest in the witchcraft and the occult. And that interest is gigantic. You only have to go into W.H. Smith or Waterstones or any bookshop. Check out the shelves on the occult, witchcraft and so forth. They are heaving with books. The interest is enormous. Check out then religious. And they'll even put some of the occult stuff under religious. But they might have the odd Bible in the King James, and they'll have one or two books by Joyce Meyer perhaps, and that's about it. There's almost nothing except falsehood, do you see? And now, if you put all that together, where are we getting the idea from that the flood generation was really bad and Sodom was really bad, but we're pretty good? I'm not saying we are worse than them. I'm simply saying I see no basis for thinking we're any better, personally. And I think the rate of decline that we have is so vastly terrible. I mean, things that even a few years ago, I remember Tony Blair saying, the Prime Minister, he wanted to be able to have civil weddings and things, but he said there were civil partnerships, but he said, but rest assured, it won't be marriage. And only a very few years later, it was gay weddings. And amazingly, it was the Conservative Party that brought it in. And David Cameron, the Conservative, brought it in without anybody asking him to, except his wicked wife. And his wicked wife put him up to it. And strangely, nobody was asking for it. Not even the homosexual community were asking for gay weddings. But Cameron pushed it because his wife pushed it with him. And he brought it in. And strangely, it was something Blair said would never happen. He said, we want to have civil partnerships, but not weddings. Now we have gay weddings. But not only do we have gay weddings, but you must agree with it, and you must not criticise it, and you must not refuse to take part in it. Now, this is only the early stages, and the church, that which remains of the church in the UK, is going to have to go underground eventually. And you're going to have to meet in homes, because you won't be able, in a public place, to say anything that doesn't correspond to the one world religion and doesn't correspond to what they say. So the only place you'll be able to preach the real gospel is in your home, in your living room. And I suggest to you now, begin to take steps now to set up house churches. Leave the established denominational churches now. Go into house churches now, ready for the time when that is the only place when you'll be able to be in a church that isn't preaching falsehood. Because churches will remain, the big steepled things with the rows of chairs will remain, but they won't be able to preach the gospel. So all of them are going to have to compromise even more than they are doing. So you might as well get out even now. That said, house churches are where we're meant to be anyway. That's where the New Testament met, in homes. There were no steeples, there were no buildings, there were no clergy, there were no services of the type that you see. Okay, well, what about this then? What about gender imbalance? Is there a gender imbalance in the wicked? If you read my book, you'll see that I'm talking about a lot of wicked women. It's not because I've singled them out, it's just that there are two principal reasons why I think there's a disproportionate number. One is that there are more women than men in churches. There's just simply more of them. And secondly, I used to run a law firm, and I think there was three quarters women, about roughly speaking, if not more, because that's the way that the legal profession's going. So I just came across more women doing wicked things than men. But if I'd employed the exact same number of men, I think I'd have had the same numbers. But I would say this, men and women go about their wickedness in different ways. So there are differences of technique, method, and emphasis. And women will tend to use more indirect methods. They will tend to use lies more. They will tend to gossip more. They will tend to manipulate more. And there are good reasons for that. One is they don't generally have the power or the authority or the physical strength to dominate people. They're less likely to occupy positions of authority in churches or businesses. And they choose the next best thing, which is to manipulate those who do occupy the positions of authority. But as a broad general idea, men tend, I think, to be more direct and obvious in their wickedness. They will bully, they will dominate, etc., intimidate. The objective is the same. The objective is to control people. The way they go about it is simply where they differ. But I think the clearest argument for saying that there is not a gender imbalance in terms of whether people are wicked, not how they go about it, but whether they're wicked, is that the generation that perished in the flood were wiped out equally, all the men and all the women. And the generation that died out in Sodom and Gomorrah were wiped out equally, all the men and all the women were destroyed. And I think that's an important precedent that we can look to. All right, well, what about the percentage of wise people? How many people are wise? Well, I would say this. Even to be considered eligible to be considered wise, you must first of all be a genuine Christian, because nobody can be wise unless they are saved and are a real Christian. Not a churchgoer, an actual, real, born-again, genuine, converted Christian must be that, just to be eligible. But of that group, which I would say is about 5% in the UK, and I think I'm being generous by saying 5%, I'm only saying it because I'm such a generous person, I would probably say a bit less than that, but let's call it 5%. Of that 5%, you've then got to say, well, how many of the 5% are wise? Because being a Christian is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for being wise. You must then go on. Also, in addition to that, you must go on to have discernment, to have understanding, to have knowledge, to know God, to know the Bible, to know his principles, to know what he says, what he does, what he's planning, to understand people, to understand the world, to understand the wicked, to know the difference between groups and types, and to see men's hearts and what they're really like Jesus could. He knew what was in men, and he didn't entrust himself to men. He knew what was in them. But that's what's needed to be wise. And that's why I say that of those who are in the 5%, I really think only 5% of the 5% are wise. The most of the 5% are either simple or even fools. That's even of those who are amongst the saved. And by saying that they're fools, what I would mean is a Christian fool is someone who, you know how it says in the Bible, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. Well, how can a Christian fool say that? How can a Christian be a fool? I think by failing to involve God in any real or material or meaningful way in his life. So for many people, they believe God exists, but he has nothing to do with their life. He has nothing to do with their decisions, nothing to do with their plans. They don't fear him. They don't think of his judgment. So I would say the Christian fool says in his heart, there is no judgment. Whereas the unbelieving fool says there is no God. But I think they're both foolish. So most Christians are simple and naive. That's where the reality of the position is. And they don't discern, they don't know God's word properly, and they don't understand the world properly. As for how many people out there in the population are simple, I think it's a high proportion of the church, but if you look out at the world, most of the world is either wicked or fools. And perhaps 10 or 15% of the unbelieving world is simple. Because you can be simple and an unbeliever. You know, people are no one's static. You're traveling. If you're simple, you started off simple when you were born, and when you were 5 years old, and when you were 8 years old, but you're traveling. You're either traveling towards being a fool or traveling towards being wise. And if at this present moment the photograph takes you and you're simple at this moment, you're not going to just stay simple. You're either going to become a fool or you're going to become wise. You've got to be traveling. Everyone's got to be traveling. And that's what I would say. Maybe 10 or 15% of the UK population is simple. And they're the ones who make good staff. You can make good employees out of them, even if they're not Christians. But that shows why it's so difficult to find good staff. I used to find it an exasperating problem, just finding honest, faithful people. That's why the Bible says, a faithful man, who can find? It's so rare. All right, another point. Don't assume that just because a person is stupid, that they can't possibly form a cunning plan or scheme. They can do so perfectly well. The point is, it's not them doing it. The point is, they've got a demon helping. They've got a demon on their shoulder or inside them, whispering and thoughts into their mind. So although they may be stupid and incapable of reciting the quadratic equation or something like that, or they don't know what year Magna Carta was, they don't know any of that. But you don't need any of that to be wicked and to be sharp as a razor in terms of dealing with people in a cunning and shrewd and sharp way. And so you will misjudge them and you'll misjudge situations. If you think that stupid people can't be wicked and can't be cunning, they can be very cunning, really, really cunning. Even the stupidest, least qualified people can outwit Christians because it's a different skill. And frequently the wicked person is like a puppet doing what the demon instructs. So they may be stupid, but the demon is not stupid. The demon is giving, from their perspective, very useful advice on how to outwit you, how to be aware, to be preempt you, to get ahead of you, and so on. So don't underestimate the wicked, and certainly don't underestimate the demons that are within them or alongside them. And also, secondly, don't assume that just because a person has done something nice or helped you in some way, that therefore they can't be wicked. They can be wicked, and they frequently are. So just because someone's helped you or done something, it doesn't mean they're not wicked. You can't give them a label to say that they're a good person because they did this or that. They gave to this charity. They did this good turn. They lent you their lawnmower. You can't say that. You need to examine their fruit on a consistent, regular basis over a sustained period of time, sufficiently sustained to form a reliable judgment. And so what you need is a consistent pattern for long enough to form the view that they are both genuine, that their behavior is genuine and typical. When I say genuine, I mean that they're not faking it. Because sometimes the wicked will fake their behavior to trick you. And they'll do that especially if they think you're trying to examine their behavior. And if you're a boss, you'll have it all the time. And a boss is surrounded by people who love him and who are nice to him the whole time. That's how it looks. But that's not the reality. So if you're a boss, if you're a supervisor, if you're a manager, you won't see, people won't behave with you as they really are. So the mere fact that someone is appearing to be something or do something doesn't mean it. Doesn't mean that they are that. So first of all, is it genuine? Secondly, is it consistent and typical of them? Only then can you form the view that this person is good, is godly, is genuine, is not fake. And people can do things just to impress you. And once my wife was on a flight, I think, to Edinburgh. She had the kids with her on an airplane. And she happened to be on, it's a small aircraft, and she happened to be on the same plane as one of the employees, a salaried partner from my law firm. And this salaried partner offered to change seats so that one of our kids could sit with my wife and so forth. And there you are, there's a nice turn, that's a nice thing. But if you were to conclude from that, that this lady was a nice person, a good person, a godly person, a decent person, you make a big error. That person went on to be one of the most disloyal, unfaithful, unreliable, dishonest members of staff that I had. So the mere fact she gave up an aeroplane seat to be helpful to us doesn't mean that that person's a good person. And so, you know, you can be tricked in that way. You need more than just that. However, you don't need a lot in the other direction. So if someone does something wicked or malicious or devious or deceitful or manipulative, you don't need to see a consistent pattern of deviousness in order to conclude that someone's devious. A single incident will suffice in that direction to know that they are not reliable, not trustworthy. In order to think that they are trustworthy, you need a consistent pattern of genuineness. And also, another thing, the mistake I've made is to assume that just because someone's a hard worker or good at their job or excellent at their work, they must therefore be a godly, wise, good person. It doesn't follow. Obviously, a godly, wise, good person will be good at their work, but it doesn't follow that a person who's good at their work will be godly and wise and good. That doesn't follow. It doesn't work in that direction. So I've assumed with people that because they were excellent workers, very, very industrious and productive and profitable, I think they must be trustworthy people that are loyal and I can rely on them. No, it doesn't follow. What it proves is that they're industrious, efficient and effective and skilled. It proves all that. Yes, of course it does. But it doesn't prove that they're trustworthy and can be relied on by you. Okay. Let's look at this. Why does God let wicked people attack you? Why doesn't God just come along and stop them all? Well, he has several reasons. We won't go into all of them. But one of the reasons why God doesn't stop all the wicked and remove them from the earth, and there are many reasons, but let's look at one. One is so that you can grow in character and learn to be an overcomer and a conqueror through your dealings with them. And one of God's main aims for his people is to learn how to conquer. It's a regular theme in the Bible, and I've set out a whole list of quotations here, principally from Revelation, but speaks of it again and again and again. And it says here, for example, "He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna." That's in Revelation 2:17. Revelation 3:5. "He who conquers shall be clad thus in white garments, and I will not blot his name out of the book of life." Revelation 3:21. "He who conquers, I will grant him to sit with me on my throne, as I myself conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne." And it says in Revelation 12:11. "And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb," and so on. And then in Revelation 15:2, "And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those who had conquered the beast and its image," right? Revelation 21:7, he who conquers shall have this heritage. But it goes on. Also, God is calling us to be overcomers. And to be overcomers, we have to come up regularly against things that we have to overcome. So you can't just overcome little puppy Labradors and things like that. You've got to overcome serious problems that need to be overcome. There have to be really serious, bad people to overcome. Otherwise, the word is robbed of its meaning, you know. But in Romans 12:21, it says, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So God, one of the reasons why God permits evil and evil people and wickedness and wicked people is to give you things to conquer and overcome. Now, how many of you have ever considered the objective in your life of being a conqueror or an overcomer? Most of us have never given it a second's thought about the objective of becoming an overcomer or a conqueror. And yet, I think I've demonstrated just by looking at the letter, the book of Revelation, that becoming a conqueror, would you agree with me, is a consistent theme within the book of Revelation? Now, if it's a consistent theme in the book of Revelation, why is it not on our agenda? Do you see? It should be, shouldn't it? And so, you are meant to be that. So, if the Bible tells you you're meant to be something or do something, then you are to take that seriously and to say, the Bible says I'm to be a conqueror and an overcomer. I must learn how to overcome. I'm clearly not one at the minute, because the wicked run rings around me. So 20 years ago, the wicked would run rings around me. I was like Pinocchio with his little lunch box, and Mr. Wolf, Mr. Fox were there, and I was skipping along, and they were going to take me to Boys Town. Oh, yes. And that's how I was. But gradually, you realize, and I realized, I'm not very smart. These people are outsmarting me. And I set about seeking to change. And I think I have largely changed. But that doesn't mean that, therefore, I'm now the prophet Daniel, and everything I ever do is just nothing but continuous wisdom. Of course not. But the point is, you don't say, well, unless I can become the prophet Daniel, augmented with a big dose of Joseph and a big dose of Job, plus Solomon on top, unless I can be all those four as a kind of composite, I'm not going to bother. No, you've got to move in that direction. Of course you're not going to be Solomon, Job, Daniel and Joseph tomorrow, or ever, maybe. But you move in that direction, and you will be judged on the degree to which you moved in that direction and took God's word seriously and said, I want to move in that direction. And even if you don't make it all the way to being the next Daniel, well, how bad would it be to be half a Daniel? I would settle for that. If I could get to be half as much as Daniel, I would accept it now. I'd say, deal, I'll accept that. Wouldn't you? Well, go in that direction then. So it's always been part of God's purpose for his people to learn how to fight. This is alien to us. It's not what churches teach. Churches teach comfort and prosperity. God wants us rich. He wants us to have jet planes. He wants us to be wealthy. He wants this. He wants that. Well, I don't see it really in the Bible. And I don't see it in what happened to the characters in the Bible. I don't see Paul having an easy time. Don't see Peter having an easy time. All the disciples except John were put to death. And the only reason John died of old age is because he survived an attempt to kill him. And even he was put on the island of Patmos. And the only reason he survived really is because God wanted him alive to write the Gospel of John and the book of Revelation. Why do we think that we are immune or exempt from all this? God wants us to learn to fight. Now, God could have let the Israelites, the Hebrews, go into Canaan without a fight. He could have just let them have it. He chose not to. He told them to clear out the Canaanites. And you, likewise, are going to have to deal with the Canaanites in your life. That doesn't mean you go around exterminating and killing them like Conan the Barbarian. I don't mean that. But what you are to do is to deal with the wicked people in your life. God wants you to overcome them. Not by killing them, but by defeating them, resisting them, refusing to bow down to them, refusing to be intimidated by them, refusing to budge for them, stand in their way, block the pavement when the wicked are coming. Don't let them have their way. That's what God wants for you. But you see, even that generation that took the land, God left some wicked in the land for the next generation to have to fight. He wanted the next generation. It says here, he left some in the land. It says, it was only that the generations of the people of Israel might know war, that he might teach war to such at least as had not known it before. And it says, now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them, that is, all in Israel, who had no experience of any war in Canaan. That's Judges 3, 1 and 2. He left some people in the land for the next generation to get a chance to learn how to fight. Now, can you see how alien all this is? Learn how to fight? I thought Christians were meant to be stroking rabbits all the time and being nice and showing old ladies across the road and things. That's what Christians do. Well, of course you can show old ladies across the road if you want to, but you're also meant to fight. You're meant to be an effective person standing up to the wicked. That's what you're meant to do. What about King David? King David could not have become the great man that he was without the benefit, in inverted commas, of having so many wicked opponents. King David got it in the neck. King David's life made mine look like Butlin's holiday camp. The people he had to deal with, the wicked, on and on and on it went. He was on the run from Saul's army. He had the king after him. And he had all sorts of people after him. And continual conflict went on for years, living in caves out in the desert and hiding away, always on the run, hardship and people trying to kill him. It made him stronger, not weaker. The experience made David stronger. It says in 2 Samuel 3:1, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David, and David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. Now you see God's purposes. God could have chosen to open up a branch of Butlin's holiday camp somewhere in Israel and send David to that. But he didn't. He sent David out to live in caves and hide from Saul and all the rest. But not only that, God caused David to fight battles against Goliath, against various different foreign armies when he was still on Saul's payroll. And even before that, when he was only a boy, God had David fighting lions and bears. Now, does that sound to you like the typical lifetime training that most churches are advocating for most of us? It doesn't to me. But that's what God does. And what happened to David, I grant you that's at the top end of the spectrum. Most of us are not going to have to face that. But you are going to have to face the same sort of thing, albeit only at your level. It won't be armies after you and things like that. But it will be difficult colleagues at work, difficult bosses, difficult employees, difficult neighbours, difficult churches, difficult this, difficult that. You will have all sorts of struggles to overcome. And that's part of what we're meant to do. And overcoming the wicked is part of what we're meant to do. And I labour it because it's not known. The vast majority of Christians do not know this and have no idea. And even if it's pointed out, they don't agree. And even if they agreed that it is what we should do, they would say, yeah, but I don't want to. I want to be at Butlin's holiday camp. I want to be there. I don't want to be in hardship, fighting, facing opponents and difficulties and trials and overcoming them. So the thing is, if you're trying to ask God to remove all trials from your life, you're wasting your time. He's not going to do it. He's not willing to remove all trials, opponents and difficulties. He will answer your prayers from time to time and give you a respite. If you say to God, can I have a rest for 5 minutes? He'll say, all right, have a rest. But if you said, can I just abdicate from life and not be part of being what a disciple is all about? Can I just act in a manner that's entirely inconsistent with Scripture and not fulfill any of your objectives and plans for me? Then I think you'll find God will say, well, no, not quite, no. No, I'm not entirely happy with that. So I might give you a 5 minute respite, but no, I want you to fit in with what I want for every disciple. So don't waste your time asking God to give you a permanent leave of absence. You know, you can get in the army, you can get like a pass home for the weekend. If you go and see your sergeant or your lieutenant and say, can I go home for a wedding? They'll let you go home for a wedding. But if you say, can I skip the Normandy campaign? They're not going to say, no, they're not going to say, yeah, you skip the Normandy campaign. It's a different thing. All right, let's look at this. The extent of people's capacity to lie. Another thing that I think we need to recalibrate is our expectation, our assessment of how many people tell lies and how big are the lies and how much damage do the lies cause. My submission is, on all three of those points, that it's very large. I think many would assume it's quite small. I think it's very large. And I think people have an astonishing capacity to tell lies, not only with express words, not only that. That's perhaps the least of the problems. Express lies, where people tell a material, express, explicit lie, I think is a smaller problem. The bigger problem is being phony and two-faced and seeming to be something which they aren't. That's not said with express words, but it's still deceitful, it's still deception, and it's hugely damaging. And because I managed so many staff and because I had to keep personnel records, one of the things God was thinking about in all those personnel files was Book 6. I wasn't thinking about Book 6 and all the stories I would one day tell, but God was. And personnel files were kept up to date, and all these things, investigatory meetings I had to have, disciplinary hearings, dismissals, etc. But also, all the tribunals I did, where I acted on one side or the other, was all for a purpose. And by looking at all those things, I was able to find so many stories, so many kinds of ways in which people lie or are hypocritical or phony or two-faced. I would much rather a chap come up and steal some money off me or tell me a lie or something than be two-faced and phony with me. I think it's much less damaging just to steal some money off me than to be phony and pretend to be a friend when he's not, or pretend to be a Christian when he's not, or pretend to be an ally when he's not, or and so on. All that is much more damaging. But look at what Jeremiah says. And this touches upon the question that the gentleman asked a bit earlier. Jeremiah says this: let everyone beware of his neighbor and put no trust in any brother. For every brother is a deceiver, and every neighbor goes about as a slanderer. Everyone deceives his neighbor, and no one speaks the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies. They weary themselves committing iniquity. And then he says in Jeremiah, that was in Jeremiah 9, 4 to 5. And then he says in verse 8, with his mouth each speaks peace to his neighbor, but in his heart he plans an ambush for him. That's what Jeremiah thought about people, broadly speaking. That's not to say that literally everybody was like that. What he meant is that in a sweeping way, the vast majority of people, that's what they're like. And it was true then, and I think it's true now. The vast majority of people don't tell the truth all the time. And I've committed myself to tell the truth all the time. So all I will do is either answer your question truthfully or refuse to answer your question. But I'm not willing to lie to you. So I'll either dodge your question or change the subject or tell you the truth. But that doesn't mean, because I won't tell any lies, doesn't mean I'll always tell you everything you want to know. I may just change the subject, like Willie Whitelaw, the Deputy Prime Minister, used to do. I was just telling someone earlier. He was the most expert changer of the subject. If anyone asked him a difficult question, Willie Whitelaw would just start talking about something else. So one of his favourites was to talk about what they'd had for his lunch. So if you asked him a question, what are your plans in relation to the budget, or what are your plans in relation to nuclear disarmament or something, he would just say, well, gentlemen, we had an excellent lunch today, and I particularly enjoyed the fish. And then he'd just go off talking about something else, just change the subject. Well, you can do that. You don't have to tell the truth to everybody all the time, but you can't tell lies. But most people will tell lies whenever it is necessary. And when I say most, I mean, sadly, most people in churches. I don't know whether they're real Christians or not, but most people who go into buildings with steeples on, most of the people who go in and out of those buildings, they're called churchgoers, now most of them will tell lies whenever they need to. Now that's the position within the United Kingdom in the year 2016. Whether it was true in 1870, I don't know. Some of you at the back might know, but I don't know. I don't know what it was like then. But probably much better back then. But today, that I think is a correct and realistic, not jaundiced, a realistic assessment of today's church is that most Christians will lie when they need to. Including leaders, when they need to. But what I'm saying is lies cause far more damage than we think. Lives are ruined and blighted. And terrible harm is caused by lies. Far more harm than most people have any idea. So telling lies is both evidence of wickedness, because if a person is regularly lying, they are either already wicked or well on the way to becoming wicked. And I'm wanting to put forward the subject of lying as a very, very important factor, which many people do not think is important. They might think murder, yeah, that's not a good idea. And adultery, no, you're not supposed to do that. But lying, no, that's not too bad. I will tell a few lies now and again when I need to. That's where most people are at. What I'm saying is I don't believe that's God's position. He really, really hates lying. So if a person is lying and lying regularly, they're either already wicked or they're heading that way in an alarming way. So lying is both evidence of wickedness, but also it's a cause of wickedness. And when we tell lies, it causes us to become wicked as well. And you have to stop it. Let me tell you this story of a liar and the harm she did. And again, on the theme, ordinary folk. She wasn't a leading member of the Nazi party. She was a secretary that worked for me. And I'm going to give her the name Tracy. Now, she was an habitual and skillful liar. She was also a Christian, or she said she was. She may well have been a Christian. She was brought up in the church. I knew her dad, and he was definitely a Christian. Now, she would cause colleagues to fall out by saying things to get them to suspect or resent one another. She was a troublemaker and a breaker up of people. And this is something you will come across from time to time, quite often probably. But she used to achieve this by just telling lies to different people to get them to have antagonism towards one another. And she'd create a whole web of lies to destroy relationships. And she was incredibly convincing. Now, one of the reasons why she was so convincing is that she looked so innocent. She looked like a weak, vulnerable, shy, introverted little person. And I think, surely, you would never ever get a problem from a weak, shy, introverted, timid little person. Well, I'm telling you, you will. And one of the things you'll get from such people, if a person is like that, then this is precisely what they'll do. They'll tell lies because they haven't the power to dominate and they haven't the wherewithal to intimidate. But what can they do? How can they get control? Only by manipulating. They can't dominate. They can't intimidate. They have to manipulate. So it's precisely such people. If a chap is 6'8" and 20 stone of solid muscle, he's hardly going to go around needing to manipulate. He'll just pick you up and chew your head off and make you do things, bully you into things, intimidate you into things. It's more obvious. But someone like that does it indirectly. So this is what happened. This is the story. One day, there was an employee I had had who had worked for me for a long time, very faithful, excellent employee. We'll give her the name Susan. Anyway, one day she suddenly changed and she became very standoffish and sort of sour towards me and sour towards her work. Her enthusiasm went down to zero. She suddenly changed overnight. Silent, unresponsive, resentful, clipped little one-word answers. Yes, no, yes, thank you. And this kind of thing. What is going on here? I thought. This is someone I've worked with for years, a good friend of mine. And her work went down, she lacked enthusiasm. But this is a person with a key role in the firm, very important person within the law firm. And there I was with this stony face that met me. But when I asked her, what's wrong with you? What's up? She denied it. She did nothing. Nothing. People have heard that sometimes at home, haven't they? Nothing. When someone says nothing, you know it's not nothing, eh? And so I knew something was wrong. She wouldn't open up about it, wouldn't tell me what it was. And I would be a lot wiser today. If that happened to me today, I would know that person's been lied to about something. I don't know what, but they've been lied to and they think something that isn't true. So anyway, it reached a point, I called Susan in. I called her in to basically give her a telling off and if necessary to give her a warning, a written warning if need be, about her conduct, because it was just no longer tolerable. Couldn't go on with her being like this. So she sat in front of me with a sullen face on, and I said, I was talking to her and so on, but something sort of made her snap and she opened up for the first time, and she said, and maybe it was the gravity of the situation or perhaps it was God prompting her, but she began to open up and she said to me, she said, but I feel upset about what you've said about, and then she gave the name of her stepdaughter. She had a stepdaughter. So that's what she said to me. I feel upset about what you've said about so-and-so, my stepdaughter. And I looked at her, confused, and I said, blank looking. What are you talking about? What are you on about? And she was reluctant to say. She wouldn't say what it was that I'd said about her stepdaughter. And but I pressed at her. And eventually, she came out with it. And she told me what it was. And I urged her to tell me what's going on. She'd been told, she said. She'd been told that I'd spoken about her stepdaughter. And I pressed at her, tell me, who's told you this? And eventually she told me it was Tracy, the secretary, who was my secretary. I was amazed. I was absolutely amazed by that. What on earth would cause my secretary, Tracy, to say that? And that's not true. I've never said anything of the sort. But you see, there was an interesting thing. She was reluctant to tell me because Tracy had said to her that I had said these horrible things about her stepdaughter. And there was I, the senior partner of a law firm. Why would I be wanting to talk about some member of staff's stepdaughter? It's just so inherently improbable. But when someone's lied to, they'll believe it. And once they believe it, it's a fact. But the thing was that Tracy had said to her, I'm telling you this in strict confidence, you see. And so she'd asked Susan to swear never to tell me what she'd said. Because she said, I'll get into trouble. And she says, I'm only telling you as a friend, and I'm putting my own neck on the line to help you. These are the phrases, and I noted them. As I heard these phrases, I was just amazed. But these are the techniques that are used by a liar like that. And that there's a method to this. When a person says these things, they give the lie, but they also give the mechanism to prevent you checking out the lie. And the mechanism to stop you from checking whether the lie is a lie is to say things like that. Asking you to swear not to tell anybody, not to tell me. I'm telling you in strict confidence. It'll get me into trouble. I'm only telling you as a friend. I'm putting my own neck on the line to help you. Now, when this secretary was saying these things to Susan, she was telling her outright lies, pack of lies. But it's a tool that a liar uses, and you need to be aware of it. And so understand that that is what they will frequently do, especially women. That's the sort of thing that women will do. 9 times out of 10, a woman would do that, not a man. But that's been my experience at any rate. And it makes the victim actually feel beholden to the liar. Ironically, they actually feel a sense of loyalty and gratitude and commitment to the liar who has gone out of their way and put themselves at risk to help them. So therefore they don't check the truth of it, because if they went checking the truth, it might come out what had been said. So if anybody ever tells you not to check something, not to question something, they're telling you as a friend, don't tell anyone, don't go and check it out, don't go and look into it. And it should set off an alarm bell in you. I wouldn't say there are never any circumstances where that could validly be said, but there are hardly any. 99 times out of 100, if someone says that, it's a lie. They're doing it to manipulate you. But what made it even worse was, what Tracy had done was to distort a conversation that had actually taken place. And some weeks earlier, months earlier maybe, I remember, I had a vague memory of Tracy rumbling on to me about Susan's stepdaughter. You know how it is, some secretary's in your room doing some filing and you're trying to do some work and they're burbling on a bit and you're, oh yeah, All right, And she was telling me stuff about... I'm forgetting the names now because all the names are made up. Tracy was telling me about Susan's stepdaughter. And there was a conversation of that type where she was telling me things. I don't quite remember what she was even telling me. But she told me something about the stepdaughter. But you see the wickedness of it. She then twisted it round and said it was me saying it. See the point? Not her saying it, me saying it. And because by doing that, the person makes the lie so much more believable, because it's actually pertaining to something real. So the things she would have been saying, I forget what, the things she was saying about the stepdaughter, would have been real things, and would have been things that were sensitive things to the stepmother. Things that would come keen, that would hurt, that would be wounding. Because of that, because they're real things, it has that sound of authenticity to it. It adds authenticity to do that. Now today, if that happened, I'd be much more on my guard. I'd be much more aware. But at the time, I didn't see it. I didn't understand it. So what was Susan? What was Tracy trying to do? She saw Susan as a rival. Susan was a very key member of staff, and Tracy wanted to undermine her. Tracy wanted to be more significant in the firm, and the way to do that is to assassinate your rivals. It's what Stalin did to Trotsky. You look at Trotsky, Leon Trotsky, he seems a bit of a high flyer, and your name is Stalin, and you think I could do without Leon Trotsky. He's a bit of a rival to me. I'll get rid of him. Now, Stalin did it by getting some thugs to kill Trotsky and stuck an ice pick in his head. Now, most people won't do that, but what they will do is drive out a rival by lying about them. And if they can use you as a boss, or use a boss or a colleague or someone to do the job for them, they will. And that's what she did. So today, if I saw something like this, instead of thinking that the likes of Tracy, a little weak, timid, introverted little mouse, would be the last person to lie about people, I would actually think, no, they're probably the most likely. That's the most likely person to be a liar, someone like that, because lies are needed if you lack strength and power and authority. Now, when she saw that everything had failed, when it all came out, I tackled Tracy. When she saw it had all come out, she knew the game was up, and she quickly admitted it, and she admitted what she'd done. She'd wanted Susan to leave, and she wanted to get her to go. And she appeared to apologise and so on. She was preparing to be repenting about it. And she was using all the sort of Christian terminology that she thought would appeal to me. But I don't believe her. I don't believe there was any real remorse. I don't believe that at all. I think she just thought it was a good tactic to use with a boss like me. If you've got a bad hand of cards, that's the best way to play them, is put on an act of repentance. I don't know whether it was real, but I don't think so. But she did at least admit to me why she had done it. She wanted Susan to leave the firm so she could have her job. And strangely, she had actually done a similar thing before that. There was a woman called Harriet. I'll call her Harriet. This happened earlier in time. So it's like on the television where they do a flashback now. This is earlier. And it'll flash up on the screen 6 months earlier. And this was another secretary who came. And she came to be my PA. She'd been quite a high-flying job. She'd been the PA to the chief executive of another, quite a major company. And she joined me to be my PA. Now, I knew her very vaguely from very, very distant. She was a Christian, and I knew of her. And I took her on as my PA. And everything was fine for a few weeks. But then a few weeks later, this girl, Harriet, suddenly became withdrawn and frightened. And she'd got it into her head that I strongly disapproved of her, and she was very scared of me. And I could never get her to open up why she had formed this view. She wouldn't talk about it. She was scared. She'd come into my room and sort of go out as quickly as she could, put things on my desk and make a run for it. And this is meant to be your PA. What on earth is going on here? You know, what are you doing? What's going on? Now, the point is, the person believes what they've been told. To them, it's truth, it's fact, it's reality. I'm oblivious. I don't know what she... I've no idea. To her, it's all fact, it's all truth. And she had been told things, basically, by Tracy, the same Tracy. And she had been told that for various reasons she needed to be scared of me, that I disapproved of her, that I wasn't happy with her, and so on, and I was talking about her, and so on. All lies. And I never got Harriet to open up. I never got her to tell me what the problem was. And after about a couple of months, she resigned and went. And I just put it down to the fact she must be one of these highly strong people who's just very complicated. That's what I assumed. And I was very puzzled by it, but it never occurred to me that Tracy could have anything to do with it. Never entered my mind for a second. But if it was to happen today, and some secretary started acting like that, I would say, has someone been telling you things? Tell me what's been said. Please tell me. And I'd try and make it as easy as possible for them to tell me. But you need to know, the person won't tell you because something will have been said to them to accompany the lie to cause them not to tell you about it. Because the wicked person is astute enough to know that they must put in a kind of mechanism to stop the person checking it. And they do. And they do. So, that's what happened to poor old Harriet. And she left and her job was taken over by Tracy, who took the job. So Tracy got herself a promotion. She got herself Harriet's job by getting Harriet to go and fall on her sword and commit career suicide so that Tracy could have her job. Now that is being done by a girl who had been brought up in church and at this time was still actively involved in an evangelical church. Now do you see why I'm saying that people in churches will do these things regularly, and there's nothing that unusual about Tracy. I've met many, 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 many Tracys. Okay, many of them. So, why am I talking so much about bosses and jobs and things like that? Even if you're in a junior position, you may not be a boss. It doesn't matter what level you're at. You still need to know about these things that happen in workplaces and in churches. Even if you're not leading a church, you need to know. Even if you're not managing a business, you need to know. You might be a secretary, you might be the janitor, you might be whatever. You need to know. Because if you can understand the way the wicked operate, you can be a really, really useful person in that workplace, in that church, or wherever. You can help the leaders, help the boss, help the other managers, help them to not be deceived. You can keep an eye out for things. Now, what mostly happens, most bosses are Robinson Crusoe. They don't have... Nobody's working with the boss, telling them things. The wicked tell the boss things. The righteous say nothing. The righteous look by, just look the other way, keep out of it. And that's what happens. Now, what I'm saying is that if you're working in a workplace, you owe a duty of care to the company, to the boss, to the owner. You should be helping them to not get deceived, helping them not to be manipulated. And you may need to report things to them. Now that may sound very alien, especially in the United Kingdom, where bosses are not highly thought of. It's got a sensitive point to me, that, but bosses are not highly thought of in the UK. On the whole, people don't side with bosses. But if you work for someone, you need to be loyal to them, and you need to be loyal to the company. And you have a duty as a Christian to protect your company from liars that are within it. So the examples I'm giving in this book and in these talks are of relevance, even if you're not a boss, even if you're not a leader. Right, well, I'll stop at that until the next talk.